We generally assume that there are two ways a person could be Jewish. Either a person could be born to a Jewish mother, which, as we'll see briefly in a few moments, isn't necessarily muskam lakol, and a person could convert to Judaism. Either one of those ways, a person ends up being Jewish. Sometimes it's a little bit more complicated to figure out how we determine evidentiary what the evidence is to establish that someone is Jewish according to one of those two definitions. One of the prominent rabbanim in America in the 19th century, there weren't that many of them in the mid-19th century, was Rabbi Bernard Eloi, who was a Talmid, a Musmach of the Chasam Sofer, also had a PhD in philosophy from the University of Budapest. He ended up on the wrong side of the revolutions of 1848 in Europe. He had to flee to America, and he had rabbinic positions in a number of communities, most notably St. Louis, New Orleans during the Civil War, and Cincinnati, where he's buried. Rabbi Eloi may be the first member of the American rabbinate to actually write tshuvas, and we have a collection of his tshuvas that were published posthumously by his son in a sefer called Milchemes Hashem. As opposed to the Ramban, who was fighting the war of Hashem to defend the Rif, Rabbi Eloi was fighting the war of Hashem against the trends of assimilation in America during the Civil War. He's famous, among other things, for bringing to the halachic world's attention the kashrus of the Muscovy duck, and that whole literature and why we don't eat Muscovy duck nowadays is really thanks to Rabbi Eloi. He has a fascinating tshuva. The shaila is more fascinating than the answer. You can dingzach with the answer. But the question is interesting just because it kind of sets the tone for the complexity of some of these issues, especially in the American scene. I excerpted for you in the Mar Mekamos. The question that came to him was from the Jewish community of Nashville in the 1850s. There was a certain Dutch Jewish fellow who came to America, married a non-Jewish American girl. They lived a secular, non-Jewish lifestyle. Over time, they gravitated towards more observance of Judaism. They ended up back in Europe. She decided she wanted to convert to Judaism. Conversion in Europe in the mid-19th century was illegal in just about every country. The way this shaila is presented, they were in Amsterdam, and they wouldn't convert them in Amsterdam because it's illegal. That's a little strange to me because I think Amsterdam was dafka the one place in Europe where conversion was legal in the mid-19th century, to the extent that someone who did a study of the London Besdin's Pinchas from the first half of the 19th century noted that even though conversion was illegal in England, if they thought someone should convert, they would send them to Amsterdam, have a gerus done by the Besdin in Amsterdam, which was legal in Holland, but they wouldn't accept their gerus because they didn't think it was a proper enough Besdin, so then they come back to London and they do a proper gerus, which wouldn't have been illegal because by civil law they're already converted in Amsterdam. Be that as it may. So these people wanted to convert, they couldn't do it in Amsterdam, they sent them to some clandestine Besdin somewhere in the middle of nowhere, and they did the gerus, but they wouldn't give them any paperwork because they didn't want a paper trail to indicate that they violated the law of the land. So this couple came back to America, they settled in Nashville, they lived happily ever after, they were from Jews. And then 15 years later, she passed away. The Chevra Kedisha didn't want to bury her because they had no evidence to prove that they were Jewish. So Rabbi Eloi is matir. Again, the particular reasons you could argue with, I think the Tzach is probably correct anyway, slice it for other possible reasons. He says, Eidach Adem Abisurin, so that's kind of questionable because the husband's saying that she converted. But he's an Ogeva Dover, so that's not so pashut. And then he says, well, she had Jewish practices. The Jewish practices are evidence of Jewishness. Also not pashut, because we paskin in the Simen in Geiris in Yerodea, Simen Rei Samaches in Yerodea, that a person is Naman to say Niskayarti. A person comes in front of him and says, I converted. Sugin Yivamastafim Heidafim Zayin. He's believed to say that he converted. Why? Essentially, a Pesha Aser Pesha Hitter, that we had no reason to believe that he wasn't Jewish to begin with. So now he tells you he's a ger. If he wouldn't have said anything, he would have assumed that he's a born Jew. Pesha Asar, he has Namadus. But if the guy's Mufsak is a guy, if we know him to be non-Jewish, and one day he comes in and says, no, I'm really Jewish, but he had a chazaka that he wasn't Jewish, so there he has no Namadus. So that's also questionable whether you could apply such a reason in his case. It could be other reasons to be Makel. But be that as it may, what's more interesting to me at the moment is the Shaila, more than the tshuva. So let's take a step back and talk about the first category. We said that if someone is born to a Jewish mother, that person is Jewish. So that is potentially a machlokes tanaim in the following sense. The Gemara in Yevamos Daf Mem Hey has a machlokes, maybe a three-way machlokes. What is the status of the product of an Eved V'Akum HaBabas Yisrael? A non-Jew cohabits with a Jewish woman. They have a child. What is the status of that child? So that's the machlokes. Is the ben a mamzer? Is the ben a kasher? Okay, so what does kasher mean? The we paskin kasher. There is a mashmos in some Rishonim, the Rashi in Kedushin Samaches, maybe one of the deists in the Bali Tosfos, that kasher, but you still need a geris. So the Vlad is not, kasher meaning not a mamzer, but unless you have two Jewish parents, you still need a geris. So if the father is Jewish, the father is not Jewish, the mother is Jewish, according to one position in Rishonim, it could be Rashi, there's only an Havin of the Gemara, it's not necessarily, there are steers in Rashi. But lehalacha, if you look in the Piskei Tshuva, the beginning of Eben Ezer, Simon Dalid, the Piskei Tshuva there quotes a number of Achronim who think lemaisa that the product of an Eved of Akum Hababas Yisrael would require some level of geiris. Chief among them is the Nesivus. Nesivus paskins, you need geiris. Even though you need geiris, it doesn't mean that you're a full-fledged geir. He says that you're still aser b'mamzeres, so it's kind of a quasi-status. On the one hand, this kid needs to have a geiris, but he's not a geir is normally allowed to marry a mamzer. A geir can marry a mamzeres, but he would not be allowed to. How do you know that? The Gemara tells us in Bechoros Nizayin that the product of an Eved V'Akum Hababas Yisrael is Chayiv in Pidyon HaBen, so you see they're Jewish to some extent. So the way the Nesivus presents it is that before geiris, he's misyachis to the father. The father is not Jewish. After the geiris, so then he's misyachis to the mother. The mother is born Jewish. And then he becomes kind of like Yisrael Gamor, and he's not really a ger. What's the lumdus here? How does this work? So different explanations in Achronim is not really our direct topic, but if you look, for example, at the Granat in his Shirim in Maseches Ksubis and Simon Ches, he makes the following suggestion, that what's lacking for the product of Eved V'Akum Habas Yisrael, the father is Jewish and the mother is not Jewish, what's lacking is Kedushas Yisrael. Kedushas Yisrael is something that is transmitted patrilineally. The pasuk says, "L'mishpacha sam l'veisav asam." So that level of Kedushas Yisrael, that level of yichus, is patrilineal. And if the father is not Jewish, so that kind of kedusha is not transmitted. In order to infuse the progeny, the children, with that kind of kedusha, so you have to have some sort of maisa geiris. It's not a full-fledged geiris. He's already Jewish, but he's Jewish without Kedushas Yisrael, and you need the Maisa Gear to create that Kedushas Yisrael.
What does that entail?
Mikvah. And presumably a Kabbalah Samissus as well. So that's the Rav Natali Trump's suggestion. The Ma'ariv al-Ghazi seems to go with this also, Lahalach. The Ma'ariv al-Ghazi on Bechoros Paraches O Samachay. He suggests maybe there's a difference whether the child was the product of znus or the product of some kind of a more permanent relationship. If the child is a product of znus, so the father is basically not on the scene at all, the non-Jewish father. The Jewish mother is the only parent of record. And then maybe we could even consider that harasa b'kedusha, maybe we consider that the kid was really conceived in kedusha because the father came and went, he was never a player. But if there's a long-standing relationship that the father has with the kid, so then there's more of a element of gius there, and that would require some kind of maisa geiris. So lahalacha, we don't generally accept this position, but it is there on the books among some achronim that the product of an eved v'akum hababas yisrael would require a geiris. In the following sense, it does exist. The Ramban, the end of Simin Reisam Ches and Yerideh, the Simin of Geiris, says that there's something called Kabbalah Schavris. Kabbalah Schavris is if a person is a mumer, a person follows another religion, and then he comes back to Judaism. So he's a born Jew. If he's a born Jew whose father was not Jewish and mother was Jewish, but he was raised in Christianity, and now he comes back to become an observant Jew, so then we require what's called a Kabbalah Schavris. He should go to the mikvah in front of a Beis Din and make a declaration that he's now going to live as an observant Jew going forward. That we actually do. We have a nusach for a star Kabbalah Schavris. Doesn't happen that often, but every now and then we might recommend that someone undergo a Kabbalah Schavris. So what kind of evidence do we require in order to establish that Salman is Jewish? The Gemara in the beginning of Sachem, Daf Gimel, tells us the famous story of the non-Jew who tried to trick the people in Beis HaMikdash to allow him to be makir of the Korban Pesach. And then Rabbi Huda ben Beseira found out about it all the way in Tzivan, and he was able to trip the guy up so that they figured out the ruse. So Tosafot there is bothered, or at least raises the issue, why is it that the people who went, you know, this guy came to the Beis HaMikdash Erev Pesach, he said he wanted to have a chelek in the Korban Pesach, presumably he joined up with some chabura, and no one seemed to have asked any questions. Had they asked the questions, they would have found out that he wasn't Jewish. So he just accepts someone who's Jewish. So Tosafot first says, source 3 in the Marmakomos, you can't necessarily prove from here that anyone who comes out of the blue and says that he's Jewish is believed to be Jewish, because in the context of the Korban Pesach, you had a rov. That rov of the people coming to the Beis HaMikdash, Erev Pesach, to be makir of the Korban Pesach, probably a very significant rov, were Jewish. And we have the right to say, as Lina Basaruba, we have the right to assume that anyone coming in a context where the rov were Jewish and says he's Jewish is a Jew. Tosafot says, nevertheless, it could be there are other Gemaras that would indicate that you don't have to ask too many questions. For example, the Gemara that we quoted the first year we gave this summer in Yevamos Daf Memhei, the story of Rav who told the product of the non-Jewish father and the Jewish mother who was having shidduch problems that he should go to somewhere where they don't know him, Zil Gali Onasif Bas Minach, go into Golus where they won't ask you any questions and you'll marry a nice Jewish girl. So it sounds like from there that no one was asking any questions. They were just marrying whoever came. So maybe that's a raya that you don't need such strong evidence. If you look in the beginning of Siman Beis and Evan Ezer, so there we pass in the Shulchan Aruch Siman Beis if Beis Kol Mishpachos Becheskas Kesheros and Mutter Lisa Meham Lechachila, that all families have a Cheskas Kashrus unless you have some reyasa, some reason to believe that they're lacking in the Cheskas Kashrus. Strictly speaking, that's talking about not having to worry that someone's a mamzer. But it's also talking about not having to worry that someone's an avid, which is essentially a non-Jew. So the Torah there quotes the Machlokas Rishonim, how far does this go? So he presents it as a Machlokas between the Ramah and the Rabbeinu Tam. If you look in the Beit Shmuel here in source number 6, Beit Shmuel traces this to other Rishonim as well. Do we say that if a person comes in off the street that he has a Cheskas Kashrus, that absent any contrary indication, you have the right to assume that he's Jewish, that he's not a mamzer, that he can marry freely? Or no, maybe you have to do some research. So the Rabbeinu Tam there quoted there in the Torah, the Rabbeinu Tam in Kiddushin, I think, assumes that you only have to do research when it comes to marrying a Kohen. If a regular Yisrael wants to marry someone, you don't know too much about the Yichus, you don't have to ask questions. It's only if you want to marry the Kahuna, where the standards are higher, that you have to ask questions. And the Ramah assumes that you have to ask questions across the board. You can't assume automatically that there's a Cheskas Kashrus. However, we paskin Me'ikar Adin about that Shaila, the Barhetev there in Sivkat and Dalit quotes a Takanas Lita, that the Takana of Lithuania was that if someone came from a foreign country and we didn't know him to be a member of the Jewish community, you have to do research before allowing him to marry within the Jewish community. So you have to, even if a person comes as a practicing Jew, he has Jewish practices, he looks like he's Jewish, he acts like he's Jewish, but the takana was that you shouldn't be misadar kedushin for such a person without a raya that he is in fact Jewish. If someone lived in the community and was part of an active member of the Jewish community, so we have no reason to believe that he's not Jewish, that's one thing. But if someone comes from out of town, we don't know who he is, there's no track record, then you have to do the research. The Chazan Ish in Yaradei Asimin Kufnun Ches, which you have excerpted in the Marma Kamas here as well. Chazanish Kufnun Ches Osches quotes from the tshuva of Reb Chaim Volozhiner, the Chodim Meshulach Simon Hay. Chaim Volozhiner there writes that if someone comes and he doesn't speak Yiddish, you're not allowed to believe that he's Jewish. So you have to, if he doesn't speak Yiddish, he can't be Jewish. So the Chazanish there points out that that's dependent on the community, the time and the place. That in Reb Chaim Volozhiner's time in Lita, if you didn't speak Yiddish, then you weren't Jewish. But in different periods of time, not all Jews speak Yiddish. What you have to look at is whether the evidence indicates that that a person has Jewish practices to say that they're Jewish. What kind of evidence do we look for? So nowadays, in Eretz Yisrael, the Rabbanut takes a position in the spirit of the Takana Slita that in order to get married, if you're coming from Chutz La'aretz, you have to have a Tudat Yadut, you have to have either a letter from a rabbi in Chutz La'aretz or a letter from a Beis Din testifying to the fact that you're Jewish. And if you're an Israeli, they'll do the biur for you there in their Batei Din. But even without the Rabbanut, the Masada Kedushin should be 100% comfortable that the person he's marrying off is Jewish and ask the right questions before proceeding with the Seder Kedushin. In the there's a volume put out by the Beis Din Yerushalayim on Birur Yahadut, so they point out over there in the Hakdama that Rabbi Yitzchak Kolitz, who was the last Ashkenazi chief rabbi of Yerushalayim, Zichrono Levracha, before they appointed a new Ashkenazi rabbi this past year, before that there were over 10 years of a vacuum without any chief rabbi. So he said as the protocol for the Beis Din Yerushalayim that when it came to Russian Jews, where these questions are a lot more complicated, because the Russian Jews coming after the fall of the Iron Curtain generally were on the heels of three generations of assimilation, so maybe the grandparents kept something, but they hadn't kept anything for the last two generations, and it was a little bit more difficult to determine Jewishness. So his hurrah for the Beis Din was that the Russian documents were a lot, as opposed to in America, the Russian birth documents list a religion. So if Rabbi Pinchas Goldschmidt, the current chief rabbi of Moscow, has a whole essay in which he outlines what kind of documents are acceptable, what documents are not acceptable, what years were documents forged, what years were documents not forged. But for a large swath of years, you didn't have the word Jewish written on your birth certificate if you weren't really Jewish. So that kind of a documentation combined with either a Yiddish-speaking grandmother or a grandmother who had certain Jewish practices would be enough to establish Jewishness for our purposes. So generally speaking, if a person is observant and has been observant the last couple of generations, as far as we know, and they've been members of Jewish communities, you don't really have to ask too many questions. You have the right to assume that they're already mukhsakim as privately Jewish. If someone comes from a secular background, a non-religious background, it gets a little bit more complicated. Those are the cases that we deal with more frequently, where people come, they need some kind of evidence from the Beis Din in order to be able to get married in Israel, in order to be able to get married in America. So the kinds of evidence that we look for in order to establish someone as being Jewish are a combination of a ksuba of someone back in the maternal line, burial records back in the maternal line, shul membership, immigration records, Jewish practices in the family, Yiddish speaking in the family going back generations on the maternal line. So there's no absolute formula, but combinations of a few of these ingredients together usually give us a comfort level to establish that someone is properly Jewish. Those are generally the kinds of questions that we ask, but every case has to be judged obviously on its merits. Then there are other quirks that sometimes come up that you have to be aware of as well. The Ramah, in the end of Siman Dalid in Eben Ezer, source number 7 over here, discusses the halachic status of karayim, of karites. So the karayim, as far as we know, go back at least to the end of the Tkufas HaGaon, the beginning of the Tkufas HaRishonim. They were perhaps the ideological successors of the Tzukim, but a group of Jews that did not believe in Torah Shabbal Peh. The Karayim traditionally were centered in Egypt, and in later years there were also Karaite communities in Russia. So the Ramah writes in the end of Siman Dalet and Eben Ezer, HaKarayim Asir Lischatim, I mean not allowed to marry a Karaite, V'kulayim Safek Mamzerim, they're all Safek Mamzerim. Why are they Safek Mamzerim? So they are Jewish, but they're Safek Mamzerim. They're Safek Mamzerim because the Ramah is working off of Tshuvas HaRash, quote in the Beis Yosef. Tshuvas HaRash says that we're concerned that the Karaites had a proper halachic kedushin, but they didn't know how to do gittin. Either the people involved were psulim, or they didn't do proper gittin. So if you have a proper kedushin without a proper get, that's going to create mamzeris. So we don't know if any particular person is a mamzer, but there's enough of that in the mix that we have to be concerned that maybe there is mamzeris there, and you shouldn't marry a karai. A savik mamzer in any individual case is mutter, but if you have a whole community where there we presume that there are a lot of mamzer running around, so then that kind of compromises the cheskes kashrus, and the recommendation of that tshuva is to avoid marrying such people, because of the reisa and that whole community's cheskes kashrus. It could be. So what you're raising is part of what the Pesukei Tshuva quotes over here. Pesukei Tshuva over there, the end of Siman Dalet, Sifkatan Mem Hei, quotes from the Tshuva's Noda de Behuda, that maybe the concern of the Ramah is only where all the karamim are in one place, ba'asur dekvi, in the malkam akvias. In the malkam akvias, then you have to be concerned that kol kavuka mefsa mefsa dami, so everyone's a 50-50 chance maybe they're a mamzer. But if someone's going to leave that community, so maybe we'll say kol deparish mi beparish, that the rove of the people in the community are kasher, and they're not mamzerim, and therefore you could marry such a person. The Radvaz in the Tshuva, also referenced over there, was more makel about the status of Karayim. Theoretically, there are three positions that are presented in Achronim. Either you can say like that Tshuva Sarash, that the Kedushin were good Kedushin, the Gittin were not good Gittin, and they are Mamzerim. You could say that the Kedushin wasn't good and the Gittin weren't good, in which case it's a net result of no Mamzeris. Or it could be that they both were good. Even if the Kedushin weren't good and the Gerushin weren't good, then some Achronim raised the question, maybe they allowed intermarriage, or maybe people converted and came into the community, and then they were goyim mixed together. And then some say that they didn't allow, in Egypt they didn't allow conversion. That seems to be what the Tshuva HaRadvaz says. Rav Avadya has a lengthy tshuva. In Chel HaChesi of the Yomer Simi Yud Beis, Rav Avadya was more positively inclined to allow Karayim to marry within the Jewish people, definitely if they've assimilated back to rabbinic religion. And the position generally of the Rabbanut is to be a little bit more lenient about Karayim. I think Karayim have their own infrastructure. The Karaite communities in Israel have their own ability to do their own Kedushin and Gerushin now within the Rabbanut. But if a Karaite wants to marry with the Rabbanut, it could be still case by case, but generally if you look at the Piskei Din that come out of Eretz Yisrael, they seem to be more makel about this. I think I've gotten the shayla about three times, and it never actually came to fruition where he had to actually give a psak because it kind of fell out of the woodwork. We haven't had to give an actual psak, but these are potentially complicated issues. They relate. I just saw a tshuva today on an unrelated topic, related to what we discussed previously. Rabbi Bo Aron, who is a member of the Beit Din HaGadol in Eretz Yisrael, prominent dayan. He has a collection of tshuvas called Shari Tzedek. So in the third volume of Shari Tzedek, Simon Dalet Evan Ezer, he is dealing with a Mamzeris question, as we discussed a few weeks ago. The shayla was, there was a first marriage, a woman was married b'chuv of the Kiddushin, and then the husband had certain severe mental illness, he didn't give her a get. Actually, as we discussed last week, the story apparently was that he didn't give her a get, and then he described some Meshugana rabbi from America came to Eretz Yisrael, and he arranged a get zikun mehabal, which was last week's topic, and then on that basis, she remarried and had children from a second husband, and the issue was the status of the children of second marriage. So the number of factors that go into the mix that he wanted to be mekel on the basis of to be matir the children. Potentially, the Kedusha maybe was never good because it was a Kedusha Tos, because there was undisclosed severe mental illness. And maybe it could be Tola that the father is really a Goy, as we discussed last time, Rov Akum. And there's another stiff, he says, the father, the first husband, was a Karai. So even though generally we're Mekel and Karayim, but at least you can throw into the mix out of half of the poskim think that you can't marry Karayim. And maybe the first Kedushin was never good to begin with. Also relates to the question of the status of Ethiopian Jews. The same Radvaz who has the tshuva about Karayim has the tshuva about Ethiopian Jews. That tshuva is, I think, Chela Dalid Simin Reish Yotes, where the Radvaz makes a similar argument that in the community there, we're not sure exactly what was going on with Kedushin Vegitin, but he has enough sphakos to throw into the mix that you can assume you don't have to worry about Mamzerus. And the particular case that he was dealing with there was some Ethiopian woman who was taken as Shifcha, whatever the particulars were, whether she's eventually Mutaris to marry. So he thought that she really is Jewish. And in modern times, Rav Avadia was of the opinion that, strictly speaking, Ethiopian Jews probably are Jewish, but it's appropriate to do a Gir L'Chumrah, which has been the position of the Rabbanut, that everyone coming to Eretz Yisrael from Ethiopia should do a Gir L'Chumrah. And that, again, has been the Rabbanut policy. The other thing that we encounter sometimes is people who claim descent from Meranos, B'nai Anusim. So people come and say that I'm Jewish because we go back 500 years to the Inquisition. So usually it's very difficult to prove that. Most of these people have been practicing Christians for generations, and then one day they wake up and think that they're Jewish, and they remember that the great-great-grandmother lit candles Friday night or didn't eat pig or something like that. So in just about every situation where someone claims Marana descent, it's very difficult to prove anything. No one has family trees that go back on the maternal line 500 years. So in just about every situation, we require a gerus, if that person really wants to be a proper Jew. There is a letter that Rabbi Aaron Soloveitchik wrote, and a letter that Rabbi Shmuel Aliyahu Zichrono Livracha wrote, a little bit more inclined to be accepting of these people, at least for the Rabbanans. But the general practice of Batei Din is that even if someone claims descent from the Bnei Anusim, we still require a gerus. Sometimes these determinations of Jewishness require a lot of research, and it's amazing what you could find if you try. We had one case we dealt with this year of someone who basically hadn't been religious for going back three generations, and they had a tradition that the great-grandmother, I think, converted with some rabbi in Texas in the 1910s. So go try to find out who this rabbi in Texas in the 1910s was and who was reliable in Texas in the 1910s. So it happened to be that there was a whole archival folders of this rabbi's records that were stored in the Museum of Jewish History in Midtown. And we discovered that there was this whole correspondence that this rabbi had with a lot of the rabbis of the time in matters of Gittin. He served as a shaliach to deliver Gittin down in Texas, and he sent Gittin other places. So he seemed to be a Yodeya B'tiv Gittin V'Kedushin. And on that basis, we felt comfortable with the documentation that we had in asserting that the gerus that was done in the 1910s was a proper gerus, even though over generations the family didn't seem to be terribly observant. And we were matched with this person on that basis. We had another case we dealt with where someone discovered, a mother already with kids in Shiduchim, discovered that she had been adopted, and no one ever told her that, and it was very questionable whether she had a gerus at the time that she was adopted. Even if she did, there was no documentary evidence of such a gerus, and the presumption then rove adoptions in America not Jewish. So this person is already a mother, was dealing with this issue of what her status is. Someone assisted us in doing a lot of research and basically got to the bottom of who her biological mother was through some aggressive detective work. The biological mother admitted that she was indeed the biological mother. We researched this biological mother, determined that she was indeed Jewish, and the biological mother agreed to submit to a DNA test so that we even established as an extra level of proof the genetic connection between this daughter and the adoptive mother, and so far everyone has lived happily ever after.